Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
We begin with breaking news in what is now one of the deadliest days for law enforcement in America. CNN has learned that a fourth officer has died after a shooting and standoff in Charlotte, North Carolina. We're told a U.S. Marshals task force was trying to serve a warrant for possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. But local police chief says that as officers approached the suspect's home, someone began shooting with a high-powered rifle. Officers killed a suspect, but as the police approached, they faced more gunfire. Four other officers were injured. And we just got a photo of one of the officers killed, Charlotte Officer Joshua Iyer. Police say the six-year veteran died with his wife and his family by his side.
Every one of us wants to be in a situation where you get up this morning and get to come back home. And someone didn't today. Keep your prayers, keep your faith. Make sure that these officers who have families have people to reach out and hold them up, because they will need this.
Officers took a woman and 17-year-old into custody. This is one of the deadliest days for police since 2016, when five officers were shot and killed in Dallas. Joining us now is Sylvester Jones, former assistant director of the U.S. Marshals Service and author of the book Hunting Criminals to Hiding Them. He joins us now. Sylvester, thank you so much for joining us on what is a very difficult night. I can't imagine what those families are enduring this very evening. I mean, the local police chief called it the most tragic shooting that he has seen in his more than 30-year career. What is your reaction tonight?
Laura, thank you for having me. It's, my heart is heavy, and I was watching news coverage early with my family, and I just, couldn't believe it. My sincere prayers and thoughts are with the families of the fallen officers. And obviously, I'm retired from the U.S. Marshal Service. We lost a deputy marshal today. So, my heart is heavy. And then I just, learned that the a fourth officer, passed. So it's like you said, it's a very tough day. Like I said, I just send my prayers and thoughts out to those, the family members, the survivors, especially, I heard early on, one of the things that we want to do when we go out, and I've been on many a fugitive operation, we want to go come home to our families. And mm-hmm. So it's a bad, difficult day.
I mean, the execution of a warrant and trying to get a warrant out to have someone, I mean, it really is a service to the community to try to ensure that someone who is thought to be dangerous is not out and about on the streets. And as someone who's worked for the Marshal Office, as you have, I do wonder, what questions do you have now about how the task force approached the operation? Do we know any details about the nature of the person they were trying to serve or anything else?
As I understand it, this person was, had firearms issues or violations. And, we take those who are known to have firearms and have the propensity to use them very seriously. I'm not certain how the approach went and what type of residence or apartment that they were entering, because, I've been on hundreds of these operations, and, the Fugitive Task Force, is led by the U.S. Marshal Service, and we partner with the state and local partners. That's gives us a lot more as far as force projection. We get more officers, the local officers, obviously, a lot of times know the local areas better than some of the, us working in the Marshal Service. So it's mm-hmm. A great part. But, it seems like, and I don't know, Laura, that the as they made the approach, that somehow the person they was trying to serve the warrant on may have seen them and just opened up on them, took the advantage. Mm-hmm. So it looks like surprise was not on law enforcement's side.
Which is, of course, what you would want to happen. You want to have the surprise element of it to undermine anyone's opportunity to do anything such as this. And someone who lives near the crime scene says that marshals actually set up a sniper in one of his rooms during the standoff. So what does that tell you about how all this unfolded?
Well, and I heard the same thing, that a sniper was set up. So that lets me know that we had to react to the force that was put on the officers, the team that tried to serve the warrant. So in order to take away the advantage of I'm gonna call him a perpetrator or a bandit. But he was wanted by the courts. When you put a sniper in there, we're leveraging a playing field so that we can take him out. Obviously. This individual, to me, somehow found out or saw them, the mm-hmm. officers and the force come in and opened up first. And I just want to add that I remember about 15 years ago when we had several similar shootings with a task force involving deputy marshals and local officers, that I know that we were, there was some additional training put in place. Mm-hmm. And the use of those heavy shields were put in place. So it doesn't look like this task force even had a chance to employ shields.
Oh, my goodness.
They can fire.
Well, Sylvester Jones, I mean, what a truly sad day to think about the loss of life and simply trying to do their jobs. And again, now we learned that a fourth officer has passed, surrounded by his wife and his family. Such a tragedy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Laura. And again, prayers and, my thoughts are with the family and the survivors. So, which include the cops, the officers, that's tough on everyone. So thank you.
Thank you so much. So tragic. And also tonight, we are following unrest, and that is spreading on college campuses from coast to coast, really. I mean, hundreds of people have now been arrested. And tonight, Columbia University says it's begun suspending students who refuse to vacate the on-campus encampment by the 2 p.m. deadline they set by the administration. Now, Texas State Police was also in riot gear. They arrested at least six people at the University of Texas at Austin just this very afternoon. And then there's this new video out of Virginia Commonwealth University, where police have begun arresting pro-Palestine protesters tonight during what the university now calls a quote-unquote violent protest. And there are no signs of the protest ending anytime soon. Donald Trump and Republicans are seizing on the chaos. Trump doubling down, demanding in all caps, stop the protests now. Looking at pictures like this, by the way, showing the Columbia campus back in 1968, flooded with protesters, has led some people to draw parallels to that era. In an op-ed on CNN.com, Princeton professor Julian Zelizar lays it out in black and white, saying, quote, "The turmoil we're seeing brings back memories of the widespread student protests of 1968, a comparison that won't be lost given that the Democratic National Convention this year will take place in Chicago. Chicago, where in 1968, violence spread from the streets onto the convention floor. But there are some crucial differences. The most important, in 1968, young men in America were being sent to fight and die, unfortunately, in Vietnam. And that may be why there's such a stark difference when you look at the polling about these issues. In 1968, Gallup asked people under the age of 30 what was the most important problem facing the United States. 46% said Vietnam. That's nearly half, of course. Now, compare that to what Harvard's Institute of Politics found when they asked people, young people, which foreign policy issue concerns them most. 2% said Gaza. Now, in a moment, the presidential candidate who was arrested in the middle of a protest, Jill Stein, is here. Also, Tom Foreman at the Magic Wall to explain what protesters say they actually want. But first, Miguel Marquez is just across the street from Columbia University for us tonight. Miguel, thank you so much for being there and following this story for us so closely as you have been. Tell me, what is happening at this hour?
Well, the protesters are still in the quad in the center, about 300 feet from where we're standing right now. The suspensions have begun, which means however many are in there, probably several dozen, once they try to use their IDs to get into other buildings, the student union building or other places to get food, use the restroom, go back to their rooms, they won't be able to do that. Also today, there were fairly sizable, several dozen protesters outside the gates here. This is the front gate to Columbia University. In support of the protesters inside, we've heard a couple of chants, a little bit of cheering tonight, but right now everything is very, very calm up here. Laura?
Is that the way they're notifying students of their suspension, that they will understand that they are suspended at that point in time? There's no advance notice otherwise?
Well, they've already told them that if they did not clear out by 2 p.m., that they face expulsion and or suspension. So they're making good on that promise. It does seem that the way this thing will play out is that they will suspend, try to identify all of the students who are in that that area, the encampment, because it's lots of tents in there. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem that a lot of those tents are being used. Once they identify them, they can suspend them. Once there are no more quote unquote students in that encampment, then it seems at some point push is going to come to shove and they're going to have to get them to move out. Laura?
Miguel, do you have a sense of how long Columbia is going to, let the tent or the encampment remain at this point?
That is the big question. So classes ended today. We're getting into finals very soon. In a couple of weeks is commencement. The area where those tents are right now is part of this massive sort of commencement area that they set up in the main lawn at Columbia University. So they will have to get in there and set all that up at some point. A lot of the individuals that are graduating this year were denied a graduation at their high school because of the pandemic. So, administrators here at Columbia are quick to point that out to them as well, that at some point they have to get back to being a institution of higher learning. Laura?
Miguel Marquez, thank you so much for your reporting. We'll continue to follow along with what's happening. You know, while the demands from protesters are varying at each university, there is some connective tissue. Most are calling for divestment. But what exactly does divestment mean? CNN's Tom Forman is at the Magic Wall to break it all down for us. Tom?
Hi, Laura. Divestment, simply put, means to sever financial ties with corporations that profit from Israeli actions toward Palestinians. That's the core definition. There are other things they may add to it, but that's mainly what they're driving at here. And potentially, there would be a lot of targets for that. U.S. trade with Israel in 2022... $50.6 billion. So in a nutshell, that's what they're saying. Cut off the financial ties from the people who are benefiting from what Israel is doing right now.
So how practical or easy would this be for universities to divest and heed this request?
That's when it gets tricky. We know already that Portland State has said they'll take no more gifts or grants from Boeing because Boeing makes some weapons. Brown is saying that if the students will break up there, they will discuss divestment. Here's the tricky part. Yeah, if you talk about something like weapons, it's fairly easy to say if universities' money can go into a company that makes weapons that are being used in Gaza right now, fairly easy for them to say, we see your complaint here. But what about other things like technology, computer science, public health, transportation, space, energy, and renewables, all of which are in trade in some fashion with Israel? For example, what if you said, we as a university are invested in computer science. We do cloud storage and cloud storage that's used by public health. Suddenly everyone says that's great, but what if that same cloud storage is also used by a weapons company or by a military firm? That's why this gets so tricky so soon to figure out what this is being used for. And it's also complicated, as you know, Laura, because so much investing these days is done by funds that include a lot of different hedge funds and mutual funds. And it's harder to figure out exactly what you're investing in, because most of these universities aren't just invested in individual companies. They're invested in funds that involve a lot of things all at once.
So then the question would be then, given the process and the complexity of it, does divesting work, so to speak?
The proponents of it will say it does work. One example they would use goes back almost 40 years at Columbia, when they had protests there about apartheid in South Africa, and they wanted the university to cut ties there. The protest went on for several weeks. A good bit of time later, the university indeed did step away from investments that involved American Express, Ford, Coca-Cola, and Chevron, simply because those companies were doing business in South Africa. Now, the question is, did they step away because of the protest or because they just thought, we just don't want to be tied up in this anymore? People can debate that till the cows come home. The reality is there is certainly a big symbolic importance to these types of protests. For the people out there, they think that's enough. It puts it in the front pages. It makes people discuss it. But in terms of financial impact, there's a researcher at Yale who said, look, universities, all of them, in all of their investments, only own about 0.1% of public companies. They could divest themselves of everything they own on that front. And financially, it might not make such a difference, especially since there are other people out there ready to scoop up what they get rid of. So symbolically, very important to people. In a practical sense, you could have a big debate about whether it really makes much difference. And I want to point out one more thing, Laura, worth thinking about here. We all, not all, but many Americans have retirement funds, and they have college funds. They have all sorts of things where they have invested money. It's fully possible that people who are very much against this, people who are involved in this protest, may have in their own families' portfolios monies tied to the very cause that they're fighting against right now, and they haven't been able to tease that out either. It's complicated. Symbolically, it means a lot to them.
So important. It's really complex as you describe it. And of course, it's always important to understand what the message is and then whether you can get from point A to point B in a meaningful way, especially as you mentioned, I think you said Brown would say, if you guys disperse, then we can even discuss this. Is this where they begin? Tom Foreman, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, as pro-Palestinian demonstrations spread on the nation's college campuses, protesters have been arrested by the dozens. Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein is one of them. Here is video posted on social media of the moment Dr. Stein was arrested at a pro-Palestinian rally at Washington University in St. Louis over the weekend. She joins me now. Thank you so much for being here, Dr. Stein. We were just talking with my colleague about, you know, the connective tissue and the ask and what's happening. I am really interested in why were you at the protest, and did you intend or know or even anticipate that you could get arrested?
No, I certainly wasn't thinking about getting arrested. I attended the encampment to basically show support for the students, because they are putting everything on the line, their careers, their graduation, their housing, you name it, really, their lives are very much on the line here in taking these actions. And, you know, to my mind, they are upholding the highest values of American society in opposing genocide and also standing up for our constitutional rights to free speech and to the right to protest. So I had been invited by some students to stop by the encampment, which I did. Then I was asked to please try to de-escalate the situation with the administration. And I went to talk to one of the assistant chancellors who was there, along with some of the select board members who were also there from St. Louis. We went, we tried, we didn't succeed. And within an hour or two, it's not just that we got arrested, we got assaulted. We were assaulted with bikes used as weapons and really brutalized and beat up and, you know, and then thrown to the ground, arms, you know, handcuffed behind our backs with the zip ties, and then walked over. So in that film you showed at the start, that was the very end of a process that was extremely brutalizing and violent. And I would point out that these tactics that are being used by the police have actually been imported from the Israeli Defense Forces, which we now call the Israeli Occupation Forces, who've been undertaking these training programs in most of states, at least many states, and certainly in Georgia, in Louisiana, in Texas. The Israeli occupation forces are part of these international training programs for police, and importing these very oppressive techniques that are used on Palestinians. They're now coming back.
Well, excuse me, Dr. Stein, I want to hear what you have to say, but there are many people who would obviously hear that and say, well, police have been engaged in arrests and are taking people down in the way that we've seen on the screen and done, certainly well before if there has been any involvement of the IDF whatsoever. What you've described, the experience of it, is certainly nothing to thumb one's nose at. But I do wonder what you called their highest of ideals and people who are the highest values.
Can I just stop you there for a moment, if I may? Because
sure.
It actually began in 2011. And this was analyzed after the Michael Brown riots and the very brutal actions of the police force. In fact, in taking down Michael Brown, that police force, the St. Louis police force, had actually been trained starting at that time by the IDF. And in an analysis done by Ebony Magazine, it was pointed out that extremely violent tactics were being imported along with these programs of sending surplus military equipment to our states and to our cities. Towns for the use
absolutely hear you. I do hear you, Dr. Stein. My point remains that police and the allegation of police brutality has far predated 2011, even without the training of Israel, or if that also exists. But I want to move on to the other point, and that is the larger issue you're talking about, because the use of force in whatever manner has been used at a school and has been used in this context. And of course, the idea that you're describing, some schools have started suspending student protesters. They've asked officers to come onto the grounds as well. Do you think that suspension or the type of punishment that you have endured is appropriate for the student body?
Absolutely not. You know, I do think that the students are standing up for our right to protest, our right to free speech, and for a value, which is basically stopping this genocide and seeking to use economic boycotts and sanctions in order to raise the pressure to do that, much like the boycotts in South Africa. And to your point, yes, violence has been inflicted by police for a long time. And the Columbia protests against the Vietnam War, 700 students were arrested and 150 were actually hospitalized due to the police brutality at that time. So yes, this is, you know,
and yet
this
it
is
seems
a problem.
There's not the lesson, if what you're describing, if the lesson is to recall and course correct from those moments, what should the schools be doing? I know this is an issue that's very important to you. What do you think ought to be done, especially when you do have some divergent viewpoints from the student body as to the violation of school policies? What do you think ought to be done here?
So after the Columbia unrest in 1968, there were policies adopted by the university to ensure that there would be due process, that there would be sufficient warning in advance. And that's all being violated right now. It's being violated by the administration, which is why the faculty vehemently objects to what's being done and why the faculty came out in great numbers to actually surround the encampment and to help protect the students, because they feel like due process is being violated. There's the fear of an emergency, but there is no danger here. The danger is being imported along with the police. These are riot police, which are creating a riot. The protests themselves and the encampments, I've been to many of them. They've been extremely peaceful. They've been educational. They have been, you know, extremely calm and community building. So I think the use of police here is entirely unjustified. This is a difficult subject. You know, as a person of Jewish background, I know there's a lot emerging now about Zionism that merits a review, a relook. This is a very hard conversation for people who are new to it. As Jews, we've been raised to be extremely dedicated to Zionism based on really a false history with revelations and disclosures of documents that have previously been kept secret, historical
documents.
Do
you no longer share that sentiment of Zionism? Excuse me, I'm sorry. Do you not believe in Zionism?
Absolutely not, no. And I think that Zionism is different from Judaism, and it is entirely wrong to conflate the two. Being against Zionism, which I regard as essentially a matter of ethnic cleansing, and land theft, essentially. That is the purpose of Zionism, to take land that belonged to other people. Yes, Jews have indeed been, you know, horribly traumatized and victimized, but that doesn't then allow one group to take land and displace another group. So,
you know, the definition, and I don't want to cut you off. I do want to have a conversation, but the definition of Zionism, as I understand it, and obviously this is part of, I think, the challenge for so many people, that perhaps the learning curve for many is steeper in the times we're in. But I do wonder, I mean, the definition of Zionism is not synonymous with ethnic cleansing by definition, but you think it is?
You know, it depends who's defining it, I guess. But the movement
I'm asking how you're defining it.
I understand the Zionist movement as the influx of Jews who presume that this land belonged to them. And to look at the actions of the Israeli government, they are attempting to take this land back and to drive the occupants out of this land altogether. And that has been very much the policy of Israel well before it was a state, since the Zionist movement began. You can talk to Jews who lived together with Muslims and Christians in Palestine for centuries, and it was a peaceful place. It was only with the advent of the Zionists, who felt like this land belonged to them, that the violence came. And many Jews left, as well as Christians and Palestinians, with the entry of the Zionists. This is a very difficult topic for people of Jewish background to come to terms with. And I see this, as someone who grew up in the 60s, I see this as remarkably similar to the very difficult wake-up of the white community with the civil rights movement in the 1960s. This was a difficult conversation that involved confronting the many institutions of white supremacy and, you know, the very challenging conditions of racism that were endemic, you know, in our schools, in housing, and so on. It's a hard conversation, but it has to be had, and it cannot be shut down. I think it's really important to have it, especially because our tax dollars are funding this war, which the American people vehemently protest.
Well, this is the interesting thing about politics and generalizations. There are so many people who, and I often hear this in my line of work, as I'm sure you do as well, that I hear varying different viewpoints on the complexity of this issue and personal opinions to that regard. And I do wonder if politics considers each and every aspect of it. My suspicions is that it does not, but this conversation has been very thought-provoking for me today. Thank you for joining us. Dr. Jill Stein, everyone. Opening statements in the case that's become a true crime obsession. Did Karen Reed kill her police officer boyfriend, running him down and leaving him to die in the snow, or is she the victim of a massive cover-up in Boston? A live report next.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number smart beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
A murder trial is now underway, and it is bitterly dividing a Massachusetts community and raising accusations of bias and politics. Opening statements began today in the trial of Karen Reed. Now, she is accused of killing her then-boyfriend. John O'Keefe, a Boston police officer, was found dead in the suburb of Canton during a blizzard in January 2022. Now, prosecutors charge Reed backed over him in her Lexus SUV after a fight apparently they had, they allege, and left him to die as the snow piled up on him for hours just outside of a friend's home.
At least from three of those firefighters, you'll hear testimony anticipates detailing statements that the defendant made to me when they had asked about the origination of some of those injuries. The defendant stated repeatedly, I hit him, I hit him, I hit him.
Reed faced a second-degree murder charges, but she insists that she didn't do this. Her attorney says Reed is the fall woman in a murder cover-up that she had nothing to do with.
Karen Reed was framed. Her car never struck John O'Keefe. She did not cause his death. And that means that somebody else did.
The true crime case has riveted this nation, fueled speculation, and pitted people in the town of 25,000 people against each other. Protesters flooded town meetings, calling for an independent investigation. Allegations of a cover-up and police corruption are running rampant. The local DA refutes those theories, but some people aren't buying it. Karen Reed could be any one of us. Thank God she has the money and the means to fight this. But if it was us, one of everyday person, we'd be in jail by now and you wouldn't even know about this. Joining us now, Peter Elekin, criminal defense attorney, and Abby Patkin, staff writer with Boston.com. Thank you both for being here. This story intrigued me from the very moment that I saw this case, Abby. I want to ask you, what do we know happened the night that John O'Keefe died back in January of 2022?
So we know that he and Karen Reed went out with friends. They had a night of drinking. There was an after party at one person's home. They were invited back with the group. Witnesses say that they saw Karen Reed's car pull up outside the home. They claim that O'Keefe never entered the home. They saw the car pull away. They assumed that the couple had left.
So, I mean, there's a lot of theories about what really happened, because obviously I think his body was found in that location. Why do you think this case is getting so much attention?
Yeah, so we've really seen this movement build up around Karen Reed. Protests, hashtags, people wearing pink in solidarity with her outside her trial. And as we saw in the clip earlier, if you speak to some of the folks at the heart of this movement, they really see themselves in Karen. They think of this as an underdog tale, and they would want someone to stand up for them if they were in her shoes.
Peter, let me bring you in here, Peter Elekin, because Karen Reed has a pretty high-powered defense attorney. But what is her alibi?
Well, what they are saying is that he went inside the house and that he was beaten up. And they said that all the evidence the defense is saying is that it looked like he was badly beaten and not hit by a car. And as a matter of fact, the FBI actually brought in some experts. And they also said nobody's concluded how he was actually killed. So those are the two competing arguments. And this is very rare. Most times I see a murder trial, you know, we know how the person died. Yeah, there's a bullet in him. Now let's figure out if you have proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Here they haven't even nailed down, after over 2 years, the cause of death. Was he hit by a car or was he beaten? And they said there's all kinds of dog bite marks on his up and down the arms and all kinds of different defensive wounds. And it's nothing like being hit by a car. And that's why I hate to say this. This case may come down to, and I hate to use this cliche, battle of the experts, because for every sort of forensic study you have in this case, there's another opposing one from the other side. And hopefully we can get to the bottom of things in this case.
It's unbelievable to think about what's been happening and how so many people have been looking at this case. And of course, the allegations of you know, these bombshell claims and the police investigation, everything that's happening. We'll be following this so closely. Peter Elekin, Abby Patkin, what happened to this man that night? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ahead, new polls spell bad news for President Biden. But my next guest says, ignore the polls. The professor who's correctly predicted nearly every election since 1984 is here to look into his, well, crystal ball. All right, my next guest says, pay no attention to the new poll I'm about to reference, but it does show Donald Trump with a steady lead in a head-to-head rematch against President Biden, putting Trump at 49%, Biden at 43%. But my next guest goes as far as to say that you can co-sign that poll and even the ones showing Trump losing and just consign it to the flames. He insists Biden is still the man to beat in 2024. Just to tell you who I'm talking about, it's Professor Alan Lichtman, who's correctly predicted 9 of the last 10 elections. And the one he got wrong, 2000, he argues he actually got right, since Al Gore beat George W. Bush in the popular vote. So if not the polls, what's he using as his barometer? Well, Lichtman says we should follow his 13 keys to the White House. Now, they're all listed here for you, and they include things like incumbency and third-party candidates, the state of the economy, and, of course, social unrest. Now, if 6 or more go against the party in the White House, its candidate will lose. Fewer than 6, its candidate will win. So where do things stand right now? Let's bring in Alan Lichtman to talk all about it. Thank you so much for being here. Listen, you have not made your official prediction yet. I see the keys. But why do you think that Biden is in the driver's seat now when all these polls seem to say he should be worried?
Remember, all the polls told us that Hillary Clinton would win in 2016. I predicted Trump would win. In 1988, as late as May and June, George H.W. Bush was trailing his opponent, Michael Dukakis, by 18 percentage points. He went on to win handily. Polls are snapshots. They are abused as predictors. The keys are different because they tap into the structure of how elections really work, which is that they are votes up or down on the strength and performance of the White House party. Now, why does Biden have an advantage? Yeah. You know, we hear all this consternation. There should have been a younger candidate. But look at this. Biden wins the incumbency key, which you saw on your chart. He wins the contest key because he's not seriously opposed for the nomination. That means 6 more of my keys would have to fall to predict his defeat. Right now, he only loses 2. Party mandate based on House elections and 2022, and incumbent charisma because he's no Franklin Roosevelt. So 4 more keys would have to fall. And there are 4 shaky keys that I haven't called yet. And this is what your viewers should keep your eye on. Forget the pundits, forget the polls. Third party, will RFK Jr. emerge as we get closer as a truly significant third party candidate? Social unrest, which we, you know, now see emerging at campuses. Will that be sustained? We don't know. And of course, foreign failure and success, which depend upon what's going to happen in the Middle East and in Ukraine. All 4 would have to go against Biden to predict his defeat. That's possible, but not highly likely.
So what about the timeline for all this to happen? Because obviously, as you mentioned, some aspects of it, it's a up and down, depending on the day. The length of these perhaps shakiness of the keys might not endure, but they could go longer. Is there a particular cutoff on when these keys have to be in hand?
There's no exact cutoff. Sometimes the keys fall into place very early. I predicted the hard-to-call 2012 election in 2010. But right now, because things are so fluid, I can't make a final prediction. But I will tell you, when you can have me on again, I expect to make my final call in early August, like I did in 2020.
Oh, come on. Give me a hint right now. Tell me. Tell me everything. Pretend it's just you and me, Alan.
Don't you have a whole bunch of viewers also listening here?
Well, if you're going to be technical about it, yes.
But I will tell you, as I said, I'll reiterate, you know, if it wasn't Biden running, Democrats would have lost the incumbency key and the contest key and would be in a terrible position. But with Biden winning those 2 keys and only being down 4, only being down 2, the 4 shaky keys that I pointed out all would have to fall against him. So unlike the polls and the pundits, I've told your viewers exactly what they should look for over the next several months. That's as far as I can go right now.
All right. Well, I appreciate that. Just next time we'll whisper. I think it'd be great. Just you and I. Forget all the many viewers that are watching right now. Alan Lichtman, I'll see you back in August.
I'll give you the true inside scoop, but it's no different from what I've told the world.
Oh, good. Well, I will buy the lunch, but you only get water. Thanks, Alan Lichtman. Nice to see you. Thanks so much.
Anytime, Laura. It's always a pleasure.
See you in August. Okay. Well, ahead, Trump dubbed Florida's governor Ron DeSanctimonious during the peak of their primary fight. Well, now it's a very different tune after they met privately, not for lunch, but for breakfast. Why they're burying the hatchet is next.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis meeting at a golf course in Florida over the weekend for the first time since DeSantis dropped out of the presidential race. Trump posting after the meeting that DeSantis is supporting him for president enthusiastically. Trump also saying the meeting was, quote, great. But let's remember, here's what Trump said about DeSantis, well, back in January.
You can't vote for the sanctimonious, but he's only at 4% or 5%. What the hell happened to him, by the way? Man, did he go down. Ron DeSanctimonious.
And here's what DeSantis said about Trump.
You can be the most worthless Republican in America, but if you kiss the ring, he'll say you're wonderful.
Well, now I want to bring in CNN political commentator and Republican strategist from Michael Singleton. Also here is CNN contributor and New York Times journalist and podcast host Lulu Garcia Navarro. Glad to have both of you here. Well, you giggled first, Sir Michael. So I'm going to go to you first. Why is DeSantis kissing the ring now? Does he want to be called wonderful?
You know, I think Republicans are looking at Biden and they smell blood. They think the president's weak. Republicans who several months ago believed that Donald Trump didn't have a shot are now. And Lulu, I see the face, but I'm being honest.
I'm just going to give you the face.
I think a lot of Republicans, those who are now saying, you know what, we're going to support him. A lot of the donors who a couple of months ago were saying, you know what, we're just going to watch and let the process play out are now saying, wait a minute here. We think Biden is weak because of a plethora of issues, the economy, immigration, young voters, et cetera. Let's go ahead and back Trump because Trump might actually be able to pull off a victory.
But they said that before. It's one of the reasons that he was running because he thought that Biden was weak. He presumed he'd be the candidate and the incumbent. Why do you think he's doing this now? Is he thinking he's going to actually be a VP pick?
Oh, God.
So, yeah, let me just give you the face. First of all, I'm a Floridian. It's my governor. So let me just say this. First of all, he's kissing the ring because he wants to remain in the Republican Party. And so, like, that is the Republican nominee. And he was playing hard to get. He was always going to come home to MAGA. There was never any doubt that that was going to happen. There was a bitter contest, and he wanted to play hard to get. And he's finally come home, and they've apparently patched it up, according to Donald Trump. Also, Donald Trump needs Florida. I mean, he, you know, notice that Ron DeSantis isn't the one that made this announcement. It was Donald Trump, you know, and it was them having this meeting. And it was all kind of, you know, this is all being kind of made as a public relations tour. You know, Donald Trump needs Florida and Ron DeSantis needs Donald Trump.
But Lulu, is it not fair to say that President Biden is struggling?
Okay, but I disagree with that.
I mean, I think we can all say that, sure, Republicans want to stick with the party by supporting the former president because they want those voters. But I also think Republicans are aware of the electoral realities here. And the electoral realities are, several months ago, most people would say Joe Biden's going to win this thing by landslide. Most people are not saying that today. And I think Republicans are looking at that data. They're looking at what people are saying and saying, wait a minute here. Maybe we should go ahead and, I guess, kiss the ring, if you will, because we might pull this off.
What data were you looking at that ever said that Joe Biden was going to win by a landslide?
Oh, Lulu, there were a lot of people saying
that several months ago. This is a country that is very, very closely divided. Mm-hmm. This is a country in which this election was always going to be very contested. And at no point did anyone think that it was going to go be handed
to Biden. A lot of my Democratic friends thought that, Lulu. A lot of them were saying, oh, there's no way you guys are going to win with Donald Trump. President Biden is going to win this thing by landslide. Well, that doesn't appear to be the case today.
I think DeSantis is making a political calculation. Donald Trump is making a political calculation. And, you know, and what's so joyous about this is seeing those comments that you played where you could actually see what they think of each other.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I wouldn't have had a kumbaya prediction with golf clubs present for the two of them. I just feel like they were a little bit, I don't know, it was just my interpretation.
I don't think DeSantis is a very good golfer.
That would probably be his favor if he was not good. You don't want to necessarily lose the person you need to kiss the ring of. But let me ask you, one person who was in Mar-a-Lago a lot was Carrie Lake. right? And she was vying for the governorship in Arizona. And now, of course, she is a Senate candidate. And a source telling The Post that Trump's complained that she is spending too much time at Mar-a-Lago and has soured on her in many ways. And Lake has responded now just a few hours ago saying, quote, "My friendship with the greatest president in American history has never been stronger." So it seems like DeSantis is back in the good graces, but she seems to be out.
But notice how interesting. So it was Donald Trump who said that now they've made up with DeSantis, but it is Carrie Lake who's having to say that she's made up with Trump, whereas Trump has not said anything about this. So this to me says one thing is true and the other thing is not true. But I am not convinced that Carrie Lake is in Donald Trump's good graces.
Yeah, but let's be honest. Carrie Lake doesn't bring anything to Donald Trump. She brings nothing to the table. Ron DeSantis, to Lulu's point, is governor of a very popular state, a state where
Republican leaning,
but also DeSantis can also help Donald Trump on the campaign trail. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of conservative Republicans who aren't necessarily excited about voting for Trump in November. And someone like Ron DeSantis could be persuadable to some of those individuals. Carrie Lake is someone who's failed multiple times running for office. A lot of Republicans are sick of her. They're ready for her to move on. That's not the case with DeSantis.
I don't care what you guys say. She brings the best lighting in the business.
That's true.
She got great lighting. Maybe she can help with Trump. I don't know. That lighting, I don't know what if it's a ring light. I don't know what it is, but it's there. Shermichael, Lulu, both thank you so much. And thank you all for watching. Anderson Cooper is next.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, host of the Chasing Life podcast. In honor of our 10th season, we want to hear from you. Leave us a message at 470-396-0832 and tell us how you chase life. It could be used on an upcoming episode.